chance to start when the 2018 season began. In late June, just before the start of training camp, the NFL suspended Winston for the first three games of the season because of a 2016 incident in which Winston had been accused of groping a female Uber driver. Yet again, the Fitzpatrick jinx lived. Once again, in a manner no one would have even thought to imagine. Fitzpatrick was less than 2,000 yards from surpassing Jake Plummer, his boyhood hero, in NFL passing yards. It certainly wasn't out of the question. And when football does end, perhaps 10 years from now, there's that Harvard degree to fall back on. 28. The case can be made that the Philadelphia Eagles' victory in Super Bowl LII, that's 52 in English, was the most surprising since the New York Jets shocked the world and changed football forever with their victory over the Baltimore Colts on January 12, 1969 in Super Bowl III, also known as 3. The first two Super Bowls had been one-sided routes, the Green Bay Packers of the NFL easily beating the Kansas City Chiefs and Oakland Raiders of the AFL. With the AFL due to merge with the NFL after the upcoming 1969 season, there were serious questions going into the third Super Bowl about whether the AFL's 10 teams could compete with the NFL's 16 teams. Joe Namath and his Jets took care of that issue. A year later, Len Dawson and the Kansas City Chiefs beat the Minnesota Vikings in the last AFL-NFL Super Bowl, and there were no doubts about the ability of the AFC, which added the Baltimore Colts, Pittsburgh Steelers, and Cleveland Browns as part of the merger to compete with the NFC. There had been other upsets. The New York Giants had been big underdogs to the Buffalo Bills in Super Bowl XXV 25 in January 1991 and had pulled off the upset. Few people had expected the Denver Broncos to have much chance against the defending champion Green Bay Packers in Super Bowl XXXII 32 in 1998, and they had won. The New England Patriots, led by second-year quarterback Tom Brady, had stunned the seemingly unbeatable St. Louis Rams in Super Bowl XXXVI 36 in February 2002. The Giants' win in Super Bowl XLII 42 in 2008 over the unbeaten Patriots had been shocking. All but one of those upsets, dating to Namath, had involved a quarterback who was in the Hall of Fame. Namath, John Elway, or was a lock for the Hall of Fame once he retired, Brady, or would get serious Hall of Fame consideration, Eli Manning. The exception had been Jeff Hostetler, who had stepped in late in the 1990 season for the injured Phil Simms and had led the Giants to the upset of the Bills. Most people had assumed the Eagles' chances to win the Super Bowl had disappeared when Carson Wentz had torn both the ACL and MCL joints in his left knee in the LA Coliseum on the afternoon of December 10th. The Eagles had brought Nick Foles back to the team the previous spring after the Kansas City Chiefs had decided not to pick up the second-year option on his contract. Foles was only 28, but was well-traveled. He'd been the Eagles' third-round draft pick out of Arizona in 2012 and had been a backup to Michael Vick as a rookie. The quarterback's coach that season, Andy Reid's last in Philadelphia, was Doug Peterson. A year later, Foles won the quarterback job after Vick was injured in Chip Kelly's first season and had a remarkable year, throwing 27 touchdown passes and just two interceptions. The Eagles won seven of their last eight to win the NFC East, but then lost 26-24 in the wildcard round to the Saints. Things went in the wrong direction for Kelly, Foles, and the Eagles a year later, in spite of a 6-2 start. Foles broke his collarbone in week 9, the same injury that would sideline Aaron Rodgers in 2017, and missed the rest of the season, replaced by Mark Sanchez. The team was 4-4 the second half of the season, finishing 10-6, the same record as a year earlier, but not good enough to make the playoffs. Foles was then traded to the Rams for Sam Bradford in a swap of quarterbacks. Things didn't go well there. Foles was benched in November in favor of Case Keenum, got his job back when Keenum missed 2 weeks because of a concussion, and then went back to the bench when Keenum was healthy again. When the Rams took Jared Goff with the number one pick in the 2016 draft, Foles knew he might not make the team with Keenum ahead of him in the rotation and asked for his release as training camp opened. A week later, Andy Reid, the coach who had drafted him in the first place in Philadelphia, signed him as Alex Smith's backup. Foles started one game when Smith was concussed in a game against the Indianapolis Colts and had to sit for a week. When the Chiefs decided not to pick up his option, Foles considered retiring. He even enrolled in online classes at Liberty University to study for the seminary. A devout Christian, Foles had always intended to be a high school pastor when he finished playing football. Then the Eagles and Peterson came along and offered him a 2-year contract with $7 million in guaranteed money to return to Philadelphia. Peterson wanted an experienced quarterback, one who knew his system, to back up Wentz. Foles played sparingly in a couple of mop-up situations until Wentz's injury. After Wentz went down, Foles played well in his first two starts, victories over the Giants and Raiders that wrapped up home field advantage for the Eagles. But when he played poorly in a meaningless season finale at home against the Cowboys, a 6-0 loss, there was gloom all over Philadelphia. Carson Wentz could take the Eagles to the Super Bowl, but Nick Foles? Nick Foles? Not happening. Except it did. The Eagles, betting underdogs even playing at home as the number one seed, escaped 15-10 against the Falcons in the divisional round. A week later, they were underdogs at home again, this time against the Vikings, who were being quarterbacked by Foles' former teammate in St. Louis, Case Keenum. The Vikings had miraculously escaped from the Saints a week earlier on a final-second 61-yard touchdown pass from Keenum to Stephon Diggs as time expired. There were 4 lead changes in the final 3:01 of the game. The Saints, after converting a 4th-and-10 earlier in the drive, took a 21-20 lead on a Drew Brees touchdown pass with 3:01 left. Keenum then took the Vikings to the Saints' 35, where the drive stalled, and Kai Forbath kicked a 53-yard field goal to make it 23-21 with 1:25 remaining. That was plenty of time for Brees, who marched his team to the Vikings' 25. When Will Lutz's 43-yarder made it 24-23, long-suffering Minnesota fans began shaking their heads in not-again fashion. Older fans still remembered vividly the 1975 Roger Staubach to Drew Pearson Hail Mary that had given the Cowboys a 17-14 playoff victory on the last play of the game. 40 years later, when Staubach spoke at a luncheon in Minneapolis, he was booed. More recently, there had been a playoff game 2 years earlier when the Vikings had moved down the field trailing the Seahawks 10-9 to set up a 27-yard chip shot field goal for Blair Walsh on the game's final play. Except Walsh somehow hooked a kick and the Vikings lost. Now it appeared the Vikings were going to be victimized by Brees and the Saints playing on their sparkling new home field. The Vikings had 25 seconds and 1 timeout. After a penalty moved the ball back to the 20, Keenum found his best receiver Diggs for 19 yards to the 39. The Vikings spent their last timeout. Then came 2 incomplete passes, taking the clock to 10 seconds. The Saints had 6 defensive backs on the field. Any kind of completion in bounds would end the game. There would be no time for Minnesota to line up for a field goal. Keenum dropped and, with time, threw a high pass to Diggs, who leaped to catch it. There were 2 defensive backs in the area, rookie safety Marcus Williams and cornerback Ken Crawley. Williams had had an excellent rookie season with 4 interceptions and already had another one earlier in the game. Now, just needing to wrap Diggs up and keep him in bounds, he dove at him for some inexplicable reason. Not only did he completely whiff on Diggs as he came down with the ball, but he plowed into Crawley, knocking him out of the play. Diggs, stunned, came down on 1 foot, put his left hand down to balance himself, and ran the last 35 yards untouched into the end zone as the clock hit 0. Final, Vikings 29, Saints 24. It was one of those where-were-you-when moments in sports. People began posting YouTube videos of Viking fans reacting, going from despondent to euphoric in an instant. The opposite, naturally, was true in New Orleans. The front page of the New Orleans Times-Picayune summed up the feelings there pretty well. Over a photo of Diggs running away from the Saints defenders, the three-deck headline said, "Expletive, expletive, expletive." The euphoria lasted 7 days. Then the Vikings, favored on the road to become the first team to ever host a Super Bowl in its home stadium, made the trip to Philadelphia. The game started well for the Vikings. They took a 7-0 lead on their opening drive. Then, after an Eagles punt, Keenum made a rare but critical mistake. As he stepped up to throw from his own 35, he was hit by the Eagles' Chris Long, causing his pass to flutter and wobble. It was intercepted by linebacker Patrick Robinson, who set up his blockers and weaved 50 yards from the left sideline to the right sideline for a tying touchdown. No one knew it at that moment, but the game was over. The Vikings never scored again. Keenum ended up with 2 interceptions and a lost fumble, and Foles pitched a near-perfect game, completing 26 of 33 passes for 352 yards and 3 touchdowns. The final was 38-7. Shockingly, the Eagles were going to their 3rd Super Bowl. Not shockingly, their opponent would be the Patriots, who were going to their 8th in the Bill Belichick-Tom Brady era. The only surprise had been how close the Jacksonville Jaguars had come to beating them in the AFC Championship game. The Jags, after scoring all of 10 points to slip past the Bills in the wild card round, had scored 45 to stun the Steelers in Pittsburgh, 45-42. The Jaguars led the Patriots 20-10 in the 4th quarter before Brady, surprise, led New England on 2 drives that culminated in touchdown passes to Danny Amendola, allowing the Patriots to escape 24-20. That set up David versus Goliath, at least at the quarterback position, in the Super Bowl. It was Brady, arguably the greatest quarterback of all time, coming off perhaps his best season at the age of 40, and going for a 6th Super Bowl ring against Foles, the backup who had seriously considered retiring to enter the seminary less than a year earlier. David won, again. The game was a classic, at least on offense. The two teams combined for 1,151 yards, over 200 yards more than any previous Super Bowl. Brady was 28 of 48 for a staggering 505 yards. Foles was 28 of 43 for 373 yards, threw 3 touchdown passes, and caught a touchdown pass. That came with 34 seconds left in the first half. Leading 15-12 and facing 4th down from the New England 1-yard line, Eagles coach Doug Peterson elected to go for the touchdown. Foles then suggested using a play called Philly Special, and Peterson agreed. On the play, Foles moved out of the shotgun as if to say something to his offensive lineman, but then stayed put, just behind the right side of the line, as running back Corey Clement moved over to take the snap from center Jason Kelce. Tight end Trey Burton lined up on the left side, ran behind Clement, and took what appeared to be an end-around pitch. Instead, Burton, who had once been a quarterback, pulled up and threw a perfect pass to Foles, who was wide open in the end zone. The stunning play gave the Eagles a 22-12 halftime lead. Brady and the Patriots rallied, of course, and took a 33-32 lead with 9:22 left in the game on a Brady to Rob Gronkowski 4-yard touchdown pass. Foles and the Eagles never blinked. They drove 75 yards in 11 plays, taking 7:01 off the clock. Foles found Zach Ertz for an 11-yard score with 2:21 to go. The 2-point conversion failed, and it was 38-33 Eagles. That was an eternity when facing Brady. Except for once, Brady turned human. On the 2nd play of the Patriots' drive, he was sacked by defensive end Brandon Graham and fumbled. Derek Barnett jumped on the ball at the Patriots' 28. The Patriots' defense held, and Jake Elliott kicked a field goal to make it 41-33, with 1:05 still to go. Brady had taken the Patriots on 2 touchdown drives that were followed by successful 2-point conversions in the 4th quarter of the Super Bowl against the Falcons a year earlier. This time, though, he couldn't cross midfield. The game ended with Brady heaving a Hail Mary pass from his own 49-yard line in the direction of Gronkowski. He had to avoid a rush just to get the throw off, and when he did, Gronkowski was surrounded by five Eagles at the goal line. They all went up for the ball, which was batted around and finally hit the ground as the celebration began in Philadelphia. Foles was voted the game's MVP, the 29th quarterback in the 52 Super Bowls to be the MVP. Brady has won four, and no doubt would have made it five, if the Patriots had pulled off another miracle. Not this time. This time, the miracle came from South Philadelphia. Joe Flacco normally doesn't stay up to watch the NFL draft. He figures he'll find out soon enough and goes to bed when he feels like going to bed. Occasionally, he might wait up to see whom the Ravens take in the first round if they aren't drafting too late. The first night of the 2018 NFL draft was a little different. Flacco was in Baltimore for off-season workouts with the team. John Harbaugh is one of those coaches who thinks it's very important for everyone to be there for the off-season workouts. Not OTAs, just daily sessions of lifting, running a little, and hanging out. Flacco would just as soon be home with his family and work out on his own, but he's now in his 11th season with Harbaugh, and he likes to keep the coach happy. It's only about a 90-minute drive, he said. In the end, it's easier to be here than to be home and get a call every morning saying, "Hey, Joe, where are you?" And so Flacco was in Baltimore on the night of April 26th, when the most overhyped sports event of the year began. He had a house guest, former teammate and close friend Dennis Pitta. Pitta was in town for two reasons. He and his wife were selling their house, and he'd been asked to join a number of Ravens and ex-Ravens at the team's Draft Fest, which was held at the Inner Harbor on Saturday, the third and final day of the draft. Because Pitta was there, Flacco didn't go to bed as early as he usually would. The two men sat and watched as four quarterbacks went in the first 10 picks. They watched the Ravens trade down twice, first from 16th to 22nd, and then from 22nd to 25th. The Ravens made the moves to add picks in later rounds. They gave the Bills a fifth-round pick to swap places in the first round and got a third-round pick in return. Then they swapped back to 25th with Tennessee and got a fourth-rounder in exchange for a sixth-rounder. It was Ozzie Newsome's last draft as the Ravens GM, and it was apparent he wasn't going gently into that good night. When the trades were made, Flacco texted Dana, back home in New Jersey, just to keep her apprised. He knew she had her hands completely full, since their fifth child, Thomas, had been born on April 6th. When the Ravens finally did pick, they chose a tight end, Hayden Hurst from South Carolina. Having lost Pitta the previous season, the team's production at the position had dropped measurably. "We got a tight end," Flacco texted to Dana. "I thought, oh, that's nice," Dana said later. "Then I went to bed." Flacco was happy with the pick, not only because Hurst would no doubt help the offense, but because a small part of him had wondered if the team might draft a quarterback early in the quarterback-rich draft. He had turned 33 in January, and it was apparent that Ryan Mallett, his backup in 2017, wasn't any sort of heir apparent. 3 weeks earlier, the team had signed Robert Griffin III to a no-risk one-year contract worth $1 million. Griffin was still only 28. And the team was hoping he might be a reasonable backup for Flacco. He had played in five games total since 2014. None in Washington in 2015, five in Cleveland in 2016, and none in 2017. Even after four quarterbacks were taken in the first 10 picks, Flacco knew that Louisville's Lamar Jackson, who was considered a longer-term project than the so-called Big Four, but a huge talent, was still on the board. When the Ravens took Hurst, Flacco was ready to call it a night. Pitta wanted to watch the rest of the round. Somewhat reluctantly, Flacco agreed. Already, the Giants were being pilloried for failing to take a successor to 36-year-old Eli Manning with the number two pick, taking Penn State running back Saquon Barkley instead. After the Patriots took running back Sony Michel from Georgia with the 31st pick, Flacco was eager to hear who the Eagles took, if only so he could go to bed. It was getting close to midnight. As the father of five, all under the age of six, Flacco was an early-to-bed, early-to-rise guy. He might have been half listening when Roger Goodell walked to the podium for the final time shortly after midnight. "The Philadelphia Eagles have traded their pick to the Baltimore Ravens," Goodell announced. The trade had been made less than 5 minutes earlier, and the various networks had reported it just before Goodell walked to the podium. After his usual pause when he announces a trade, Goodell said, "With the 32nd pick in the 2018 NFL draft, the Baltimore Ravens select Lamar Jackson, quarterback, Louisville." Jackson was the only player invited to New York still in the green room, wearing a green suit for the occasion. He bounded joyously onto the stage, still a little frustrated that 31 teams had passed on him, but relieved to be a number one pick. Perfect team for him, Doug Williams thought, sitting in Washington's war room, because he doesn't have to play right away. As the first African-American quarterback to win a Super Bowl, Williams always has an eye out for African-American quarterbacks because he knows, even though things are better now than they were when he was a rookie in 1978, it is still a more difficult road for most than for white quarterbacks. Jackson had had to deal with a number of old white men, including Bill Polian, the Hall of Fame ex-GM of many teams, insisting he should be a wide receiver. Polian had said, among other things, that Jackson was too short. Jackson is 6 feet three. Baker Mayfield, the number one pick in the draft, is 6 feet and a half inch. Flacco wasn't concerned with whether Jackson was white or black. He and Pitta looked at each other and started laughing, both a little shocked by what they had just heard. You could say whatever you wanted, but the Ravens had just taken someone who would be looked at as Flacco's successor. Flacco had signed a contract extension in 2016 that could keep him in Baltimore through the 2021 season, but there was an out for both sides after 2019, meaning the Ravens could let Flacco go then, or Flacco could opt to leave, or the team could, in theory, do what the Chiefs had done with Alex Smith, trade him with one guaranteed year left on his contract following the 2018 season. Flacco wanted to play at least through the end of his contract. He would turn 37 in January 2022. He might want to play beyond that, but he at least wanted to play that long, preferably in Baltimore. Flacco and Pitta were still digesting the announcement when Flacco's phone rang. It was John Harbaugh. "Hey, Joe, we drafted a tight end for you," Harbaugh said. Flacco almost laughed out loud. "John, you aren't calling me at midnight to tell me we drafted a tight end," he said. Harbaugh dropped the act. "We all felt this was an opportunity looking down the road a few years," he said. "I think you know that." Flacco knew that, but it didn't fill him with confidence about what lay down the road. He decided against texting Dana again, figuring she was either struggling with the baby or trying to grab some sleep. The next morning, he called and told her the news. "What does it mean?" Dana asked. "I don't really know," Joe answered, "but it means that change is coming at some point." 2 days later, as requested by the team, Flacco appeared at the draft fest in the Inner Harbor. He was there to sign autographs, take pictures, interact with the fans. But the drafting of Jackson had changed the dynamic of the day. Flacco had spoken to Chad Steele, the Ravens' director of publicity, several times before the event. A lot of their conversations were about logistics. But knowing that circumstances had changed for Flacco with the Jackson pick, Steele told him not to worry about the media, who would inevitably show up. "There's no need for you to talk unless you really want to," Steele said, knowing that was unlikely. "We'll have people, security, around you when you go from place to place. There will be guys, reporters there, but you don't have to say anything. Just keep moving." Flacco did as instructed. When Baltimore Sun columnist Peter Schmuck and ESPN Ravens beat reporter Jameson Hensley approached him, Flacco just said, "Not today, guys." "It wasn't a big deal," Flacco said later. "I like both those guys. It just wasn't the time or place. I mean, what was I going to say in 30 seconds? Not much, one way or the other." Naturally, though, his "not today, guys" stirred up the local media, creating stories about how upset Flacco was with the pick. He wasn't crazy about the idea, but he did understand. "It's a business," he said. "I get it. I have to be realistic, though. They didn't take a guy whose skill set is similar to mine. If he's good, and I think he is, there's going to come a time when the offense will have to change if he's going to play." Because Flacco was in Baltimore for off-season workouts Monday to Thursday, leaving to return home most weeks on Thursday afternoon, and Jackson was in town on weekends for rookie minicamps, the two didn't cross paths until the team's first official OTAs in late May. Much was made of Jackson saying he hadn't yet met Flacco after his first weekend in Baltimore, because clearly this was going to be an ongoing story. The veteran with a Super Bowl ring and the kid who was his successor in waiting. By the time training camp rolled around, the Ravens quarterback room had to be the most interesting in football. Three first-round draft picks, Flacco, number 18 in 2008, Griffin, number 2 in 2012, and Jackson, number 32 in 2018. One had risen to stardom, won a Super Bowl, and had ups and downs since then. One had been a runaway star as a rookie, and then fallen to being a low-risk free agent signing. The third had yet to begin writing his NFL story. All around the league, teams and their quarterbacks were starting over. There was still nothing quite like being an NFL quarterback financially. Flacco would be paid $24.25 million in 2018. Andrew Luck hoped he would earn the $24 million he was due in Indianapolis. Alex Smith would make about $23.5 million in his new home in Washington once his old contract for $18 million was up. Ryan Fitzpatrick wasn't in their league at $3.3 million, but he wasn't complaining. He knew that only a handful of the members of Harvard's class of 2005 were likely to earn as much. Other quarterbacks had signed lucrative new contracts, among them Kirk Cousins and Case Keenum, who had gotten a $16 million per year raise going from Minnesota to Denver. Josh McCown, at age 39, had signed a $10 million contract with the Jets as insurance, even though they had used the number 3 pick to draft Sam Darnold, presumably as their franchise quarterback. Doug Williams had become the highest paid player in the history of his team after being named MVP of Super Bowl XXII 22 in 1988, leading Washington to a 42-10 rout of Denver after falling behind 10-0 in the first quarter. The new contract was worth $3.5 million for 3 years, far less than backup money nowadays. "It's fine with me," Williams said with a broad grin. "I can tell you from personal experience that they earn every dollar, and the best ones are worth every penny to their teams and to the league. Everyone takes a beating in football, but when you get hit as a quarterback, you get hit. You're usually helpless when some huge guy running all out slams into you. It hurts. Every single time it hurts. But 99% of the time you get up and go back to the huddle and call the next play. If you can't play through pain, you can't play." The night before his Super Bowl, Williams had to have an emergency root canal because of an abscessed tooth. No way would it keep him from starting. Late in the first quarter, Williams twisted his ankle badly while being sacked. Because trainers came onto the field, Williams had to come out. Jay Schrader, whom Williams had replaced as the starter for postseason, came in. He was sacked, and Washington had to punt. On the sideline, Williams told Coach Joe Gibbs he was ready to go after his ankle had been wrapped. Gibbs was uncertain, but decided to see how Williams looked for one series. On the next 5 series, all in the second quarter, Washington scored, Williams throwing 4 touchdown passes. Washington led 35-10 at halftime and never looked back. "No way was I not going back in," Williams said years later. "It was the Super Bowl. Quarterback is an ego position. You can't play it without an absolute belief in yourself. I believed, knew, I was a better quarterback than Jay. I wasn't leaving that game in his hands." The two quarterbacks had never gotten along. Once, when it appeared Schrader was hurt during the regular season, Gibbs had sent Williams into the game. Schrader had angrily waved him off as if Williams didn't deserve to be on the same field with him. Williams hadn't forgotten. And yet, "Jay was a good quarterback. He was a competitor. I don't have any hard feelings directed at him." If you play quarterback in the NFL, you're part of a fraternity. In the grand scheme of things in sports, it's a very small fraternity. I get asked a lot, "Tell me what it's like to play quarterback in the NFL. You did it, and did it well." My answer is that I can't explain it. You have to have done it. You have to have felt it, all of it. I can't explain what it feels like to walk into a huddle and have all eyes looking at you, expecting you to take control and lead. He leaned back in his chair, one more memory flashing through his head. December 11, 1977, he said, the date still embedded in his mind. It was my junior year at Grambling. We played a game in Tokyo against Temple, which was a very big deal. First time two American college teams played over there. It was called the Mirage Bowl. Back then, Temple was a very good Division I program, and we didn't get many chances to play Division I teams. We were 9-1 and down 32-28 with a little more than a minute to go, and we had the ball on our own 15. I came into the huddle, and there was a lot of chatter. One of our linemen said, "Only one voice in this huddle." Everyone shut up. We drove the length of the field and won, 35-32. There's nothing like the feeling you have when you succeed playing the position and nothing like the feeling when you fail. It's always on you. It has to be. You have the ball in your hands on every play. No one else does. I've been retired almost 30 years, but I can still get chills looking back on when I played, and I still get them when I see someone take a team 85 yards in a minute, knowing there's only one voice the other 10 guys are hearing, huddle or no huddle. I still love that feeling, even vicariously. There's nothing quite like it. Of all his Super Bowl memories, one stands out for Williams. He had received the MVP trophy, having thrown for 340 yards and four touchdowns, and walked off the field in San Diego's Qualcomm Stadium, the trophy in his arms. The first person he saw in the tunnel was Eddie Robinson, his old college coach at Grambling, the man who had taught him about toughness and how to be a quarterback. "Coach Rob was standing there waiting for me," Williams said, his normally booming voice growing soft. "He reached up and put his arm around my neck and said, 'I'm proud of you, not for the touchdowns or for that trophy. I'm proud of you because you went down, you were hurt, and you got back up and came right back into the game. They couldn't keep you down. That's what I'm proud of you for, more than anything else.' When it's all said and done, that, more than anything, is what quarterbacks have to do. They all go down. It's the ones who get up who achieve greatness. And all will tell you the same thing. It's not nearly as easy as it looks." This is John Feinstein. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Quarterback, Inside the Most Important Position in the National Football League. This program was directed by John McElroy. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2018 by John Feinstein. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.